Right. Well, yeah. Thanks, Lauren, for the introduction and for organizing this great event. And hi, everyone. Yeah. So my name is Martin. Today I'm going to give like 5 lectures on tensor networks, which is sort of my background. As Lauren said, I was also post-secure API for a long time. Now I'm back for the first time since I left about 3 years ago. It's a great place. I really like it here. Okay, so this is going to be a Blackboard lecture mostly. I'll try to switch maybe during the later lectures to like working hybrid with my iPad here. But for the first 2 or 3 lectures, we'll probably stay on the Blackboard. So this is an overview of the things I would like to cover. Well, I'm not sure if we can cover everything, but we'll try our best. And today is day one, so these are the things that I want to cover today, which is, you know, basically some sort of a review and setting the basic language, because I'm not sure how much people know about everything. So this is basically, for some of you, it might be already, you know, you might already know a lot of that. Maybe some don't. Please let me know if it's too boring. Otherwise, I'll just keep going. So this will be mostly many-body wave functions, an introduction to what is many-body physics, what are many-body wave functions, what is entanglement, what are density matrices, and matrix factorization. So this is like sort of the basic building blocks that we'll need throughout these lectures to later on go and understand tensor networks, or build on top of that, we'll build an understanding of how tensor network algorithms work. Yeah, so that's pretty much it. If you have questions, please stop interrupting me at any point. Feel free to ask. It would be great if we could have a conversation. With that, I'll go ahead. All right, so the first thing I want to cover is essentially quantum many-body wave functions. Okay, so why do we care about quantum many-body wave functions? So quantum many-body wave functions are sort of the if you think of quantum computing, for example, they naturally appear there. These are the basic ingredients or the basic objects that you have to deal with all the time. And to be able to understand what many-body wave functions are, we'll start with something simpler, namely so-called D-level systems. So the D-level system is the fundamental Lego block, if you want to say so, of many-body physics. So you have this is a quantum system, usually denoted by a vector psi, that can be written in a basis of d orthogonal levels. Usually written something like this. All right. So you have a wave function psi here that is written as psi I, where I goes from 0 to d minus 1, or sometimes I'm also just write from 1 to d. Okay, so this is very basic. This can be written as a vector. So let's actually start with 1 here. Yeah, that's psi 1, psi 2, to psi d. So this is basically linear algebra. So these psi's here, these are the complex coefficients of your wave function. Coefficients of the wave function. All right, I think that's, please, yeah, let me know if I'm going too quickly. Examples, you know, spin 1/2 system. It's right here. An example, spin 1/2 system. There the wave function is written as something like this. All right, so you have a basis of two states, a spin up and a spin down. There are like coefficients in front of them. So the wave function of a spin 1/2 system is a vector with a dimension of 2, and usually we'll have to normalize it. So I will always assume that implicitly it's normalized, and if not, then I will explicitly state that. All right, so now this is what we call, you know, now we have a single quantum system. So what is now a many-body quantum system or a many-body system? Many-body system is a system of many bodies. Okay. This happens when you, instead of just having one spin, you have multiple, right? Like an example would now be two spins. So instead of having a single spin, you go with another one, two spins. Now in this case, the wave function is, again, there is again a wave function for this quantum system, psi, and that wave function is now written in a larger basis set. So usually you write it like this. You have some psi, I2, I1, tensor, I2. So this is now a two-body system. So now you have like two spins. What happened here, you have a larger basis. So you have again a basis. So this basis is the direct product. That's what this cross here means. So this is a basis, sometimes also written as I1, I2. So these are basis vectors. They are the direct products of the basis vectors of this single spin system. So this is a basis. So this here is a basis for spin one. Spin number one. And this thing here is the basis for, you know, spin two. Spin number two. And the basis for the whole system is the combination of those two. And here in front, we have again the expansion coefficients of the wave function. These are again complex amplitudes. All right, and if you, you know, want to go, you can also write this in this way. You know, again, a vector now with dimension four. And that's, that's pretty standard. So if you extend that to many spins, right, you could have like many more, for example, nine. In that case, this the wave function for this system becomes a multi, you know, an extended sum where you have spin I1, spin I9, some coefficient, and then the basis. And now I'm using again this notation where I just I will never write out the tensor product explicitly. I'll just, you know, concatenate it into like this single vector here. So this is now, this is a wave function for nine spins. And no, I'm not going to write that out. It's again a vector with many, many coefficients. So now how many do you have? So I'll try to answer sometimes. I don't know how you feel, but maybe we can. Sometimes I'll ask a question and then feel free to give an answer. If not, then I'll just go ahead. But who knows how many, how does that grow with the number, you know, the number of spins? How many coefficients do you need?
2 to the 9th.
Yeah, exactly. So it's growing. So this grows exponentially, right? So the number of coefficients, grows something like exponentially with the number of spins. So this is what people also often call the curse of dimensionality. Which means that the parameters you need to store that wave function, just the number of parameters grows exponentially. And this means that you can only treat very small systems. And one of the goals of this lecture and of research in tensor networks in general is to find ways to alleviate this problem, this curse of dimensionality for certain problems, for certain types of problems that people are interested in. Okay, let's move it up. This is a myth, I think. All right, okay, so I'll now introduce some sort of diagrammatic notation that we will use throughout the rest of the lecture. Diagrammatic, so I'm not, so my English isn't the best. There might be some typos. Oh, never mind the typos. Okay, so diagrammatic notation. So we'll use like one of the tensor networks come with a very powerful diagrammatic notation that is extremely useful, and we'll use it throughout the lecture. And I'm trying to introduce the basic notations at this point. So let's go back to our system of two spins. So we have a wave function, which is given by such an expression here, where this is a sum from 1 to 2. So one way of representing this vector is just in terms of such an object here. And that's, you know, a tensor. So this, oh, let me actually redraw that. Let me move it a little bit here. So this object here, we can represent as such an object. So this should represent a tensor now, or in this case, a matrix. It has two indices. Each of the legs that comes out of this square is an index I1 and an index I2. These indices run over certain values. For spin 1/2 systems, there is essentially 4. So there is a 1 that is, I need to start indexing with 1. 1, 2, 2, 1, and 2, 2. Okay, so there are like 4. So this is just a tensor that has like 4 elements in it. And we'll just, I'm just like explicitly writing it out in this way. Anyone is familiar with this? Okay. If you extend that, you know, you can have, actually, let me, yeah, so let's, and, oh, we'll do it here. So if you go, you can also write this, you know, you can have a wave function of more. Again, you could have, let's say, 9. So then it goes to I9. So you have a wave function of 9 spins, I1 all the way to I9. So I'll just remove this here because it's a little bit cumbersome. So this was this tensor here. And in this case, this just becomes a larger object. Now it has, 9 legs, I9. Okay, so graphical representation of the wave function that later on we'll use to do certain types of calculations, or to at least draw diagrams that will denote some sort of calculation. Okay, so these are now, this is a tensor. And a second thing that I'd like to introduce at this point is simple calculations. Or actually, let's actually list a few of these objects that we can have. So there is something, if something, you know, has nothing sticking out, just a blob with nothing, then that's a scalar. This thing here will be a vector. It has one leg coming out, so that's just, you know, a vector. If it has two coming out, then that's a matrix. And then we'll stop giving it special names. So this is just an order 3 tensor. And all that comes after here will just be called an order n tensor. So an n is the number of legs that come out of this. Okay, so we can do calculations with these, or operations. Those operations that we're considering here. Yes, go ahead.
So for those objects, are those the spiders in ZX calculus, or they are their own thing?
Sorry, if they're?
Are they spiders in ZX calculus, or they are their own thing?
No, I mean, they are, so these are really just, each of this is just a collection of numbers, of complex numbers. They don't have any structure at this point. So this is just a graphical representation of a number. For example, 5 or something like that.
So do you distinguish between the colored node or the uncolored node?
So I haven't introduced any color or any type of other additional property on those tensors yet. There can be additional structure to these types of objects, but I haven't introduced that at this point. So at this point they're pretty structureless. There's nothing. It's just an array or a collection of numbers that has, you know, that where the numbers are sort of associated with indices. So they're, you know, these they're each number has like its own set of indices that it comes with.
Just a small, from someone online, they're just saying, I think with the camera view, it's a bit, if you could just write a bit bigger.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I will. All right. I'll try. Thanks. Yeah, is that any, or is that?
Can I understand the filled and unfilled spider, or like the node, as the same thing?
Oh, that's what he said. Oh, yes. Sorry. I see what your question is. Yes. There is nothing. Yeah, yeah. So you're asking, sorry, that was actually my bad. So filled or unfilled doesn't mean anything.
Oh.
It doesn't mean anything. So sorry about that. So it's just sometimes I'll just fill them maybe because they're better visible, but it doesn't have any meaning. So they're all the same. All right, so then what we'll do in the following, or one type of operation that is like constantly coming up, is called a contraction. I'll just like write out, you know, a few operations now in a diagrammatic notation. So within tensor networks, one of the things that is done a lot are things like matrix multiplications. So for example, matrix multiply is, if you write it out, you have a matrix A and a matrix B. Let me actually write this way. C written in a matrix notation is AB, and that is nothing else than a sum over some index. Or we can write this as C ij is sum over aim bmj, and the sum goes over m for whatever the index of that, so whatever the dimension of these matrices is. Yeah, and that's it. So this is a way of this is just a matrix multiplication. That's a special case of an operation that we call tensor or contraction, and there is a very nice way of representing that with these objects here. Namely, you just you represent your matrix A as this object, and your matrix B as this object, and the contraction is simply done by, you know, connecting two objects with a line. So a connected line between those two objects means that there is an index that I'm summing over, in this case the index m here, and this is just a way of representing the matrix multiplication. All right, is that, it's very basic, and there is nothing, yeah.
Is there like a notion of orientation here that we need to worry about? Like, how do you know that's the right index to sum over?
In principle there is, and you can add additional structure to the diagram. So sometimes what people do is, in this case, you know, you could, for example, say that you could do something like this, right? And then you'll always know. So then you add you break that symmetry between those two legs, and then you know that one leg is different from the other. But in general, yes, you have to be worried about. So what I think the question is, you know, how is that different from something like this, right? This is,
sure.
Yeah. So I mean, this. So in most cases, it's clear from the context how each leg should be connected with each other. But you have to be careful about it.
Should be like the same with conjugation.
Yeah. So conjugation is. You can represent that. Yes. I mean, what we'll do when we want to represent a conjugation is essentially, you do something like this, you know, a bar on top of it. So that will be conjugation, and then transposition would be something like this. I'm pretty bad at drawing this, but that would be the complex, you know, the Hermitian conjugate of that thing. So this is sort of the way you represent certain types of operations. Yeah, and then other ones are, for example, computing the, you know, a norm of a vector. So you could have a vector v, another vector with this could be the complex conjugate in this case. And that would just be, you know, that is an object that has no legs, so it's a scalar, and that will be the norm of that object. And you can just, in general, draw diagrams of more complicated structures, something like this. And then, you know, this is another tensor network. And this, I'm just making that up as I go. One thing that is sort of sometimes, you know, good to see is that this is the trace. This is the trace of the matrix A. All right. Okay. So I'll bring down the top. Oh no, actually, I have one more.
Maybe before you do that, there's an online question.
Yes.
Does the shape of the blob, for example, circular versus circular, as drawn in the first and second, signify anything? Or what matters is only that it is some blob of any shape?
So the shape, so you can add additional structure or additional information by using different types of shapes, which people do, and we'll later on in the course see that some certain properties of these tensors will be, you know, represented by a certain type of shape or by a certain shape, for example, a triangle. So that's one of the shapes that we'll encounter. So let me actually move that down so that we can still see that from before. Okay. All right, so now there is, let's do another thing I want to quickly cover is the computational cost of contractions, because that's something that so one of the themes of tensor network algorithms is that they should be efficient in a computational sense and in a memory sense. So, you know, in the resources that you would need to do any calculations, they should scale polynomially. So the cost and the basic operation that you will meet a lot during these lectures is contraction of tensors. And this is like, that has a cost. It has a computational cost to multiply two matrices together and also two tensors. And there is a very simple, as a rule of thumb, if you design an algorithm or if you have a complex tensor network that you want, to contract, you want to understand the cost of that contraction. And as an example, we again look at matrix multiplication. So this is, you know, let's write AB. You have two matrices. The cost of such a contraction, yes?
Sorry, this is going back to what you were saying when you were drawing something on the previous board, but someone asked, isn't there a convention to represent wave function norm by contracting a tensor with itself upside down rather than putting the bar on the tensor?
Yes, you can also do that. There is a convention for that. That's right. That's what people usually do. But we'll see that later in the course. But for now, it just So I didn't want to like go into like so much detail at this point. Okay, so computational cost. So the computational cost of such a contraction is that's something you can work out. It's like multiplying two matrices together. If these matrices have dimensions of d each, so this is a d by d matrix, d and d, and this is another d by d matrix, d by d. So then the computational cost of this, the cost of this operation, is d cubed. Let me write it this way, d cubed. The way you can see, there is a simple rule that lets you like immediately tell you the computational cost of a tensor network diagram simply by counting the number of bonds you're seeing. In this case, and you just multiply the number of bonds or the dimension of each bond. You have three bonds, you have to multiply each of these dimensions of the bonds together, and this will give you the computational cost. So in this case, it's like d by d by d, right? Very simple. Another example would be, again, let's look at this. This is it's multiplying two vectors together, something like a scalar multiplication. So there is only one bond dimension or one connection here. Let's assume it has a bond dimension d, and then the cost of that is d. And yeah, and then let's try another one. What about, and I'll let you guys, you know, wonder about that. So what would that be? Any guess? D to the 4, yeah, exactly. That has a cost of D to the 4.
What by computational cost, is that like number of operations you need to perform, or what is that number?
Yeah, so it is essentially the number of floating point operations you need to perform. So the cost is, this is the number of floating point operations that you have to perform to compute the result. And so this is what people usually call the cost of a computation. Okay, so I was actually, so an important point here, I was only drawing binary operations here because binary operations, that rule applies. If you have more complex operations, it becomes less, then it's not clear anymore. So if you, for example, you have something like this, let's see, you have, let me draw a simple diagram. You have this operation. That's an operation that comes up quite often. So this operation here, who can like try to guess what's the cost here? So it's not, there is no, yeah. So in this case, the answer is there is an optimal way of contracting this, but you have to find that out. So it's not straightforward to find that. It's actually a hard problem to do that. And the takeaway point that I want to the key takeaway is that the contraction, like the cost of a contraction, if you have more than two tensors, is like hard to figure out, and it depends on the order in which you are going to contract these tensors together, right? For example, you could do something like this. You could first contract those two together, right? So then you would end up with this object. And this contraction would have some cost, right? You were contracting 1, 2, 3 legs contracting this object here with first those two together, and then this object could be contracted with this. So then you would end up with something like this here. And then you could do the last one by just taking in this thing here. And you would end up with such an object. And there is a cost for each of those binary contractions that I was doing. There is a cost associated with it. And you would have to, go and like look at the cost. And the total cost is the sum of all these individual contributions that you did. Okay. So, yeah, that's what I want to say here. And again, so the finding for a very complex diagram, finding the optimal way to contract it, the one that has the lowest computational cost, so the lowest number of floating point operations, is an NP hard problem. People are trying, have heuristic ways of doing that. They, you know, you can find, come up with heuristic algorithms to sort of try to find a good way. But in general, there is no known algorithm who will like scale. Will not scale very poorly with your problem size. Yeah.
So if you have one of these, the overall cost is like the highest order of any individual binary operation.
Yes.
Like you would say, if the highest one was like D to the 5 or something, you'd say that this is D to the 5.
Yeah. Yes, so that is the leading cost. There is a leading cost associated with it. So it breaks down into like individual pieces, and one will be the leading cost that has the largest polynomial of this bond dimension. This is the one you usually have to worry most about. And that's the, you know, so you try to make the leading one as small as possible. All right. Okay, so.
I'm sorry to just for people online, I think it's not your fault, but they want to zoom in the camera a little bit more. So if possible, see how on the middle chalkboard right mm-hmm. now, after you have vertical lines and you have day one, day two, vertical line after day two, is it possible to write only to the right of that?
I see. Yeah, of course.
You don't need anything now, but just for the next board.
You're saying to the right of here?
Yeah, then they'll be able to zoom in. The online
okay. Okay. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. All right. So I'll go and erase a few. Let's erase this one. so the next thing I want to talk about are essentially many-body Hamiltonians, just to give you a quick overview. So one of the goals that, or one of the big themes in tensor networks is like finding approximations to ground states of many-body Hamiltonians. And I just want to like highlight a few Hamiltonians that are relevant or that people usually care about. So, all right, so you said starting here, right? I'll make a reminder for myself. All right. So in general, the problem in quantum physics is you have like a Hamiltonian, right? That describes the behavior of your system. I think people usually, I'm not sure if I, let me quickly write it down, but I mean, so something like this, where this could be a sum. You may have a system of electrons and a system of nuclei. Where I here will be denoting some sort of electrons, and A will be atomic nuclei. And what you typically, in condensed matter physics at least, want to do is compute the ground state of, or find, you know, approximations to. So this is a sum over electrons. So this is like this is a simplification of the so-called many-body problem. So what you have here are nuclei. So here could be an atom, and another atom could be here, you know, in 2D or maybe here. And then you have electrons like in between. And the nuclei have some charge A or ZA. The electrons have a charge E. And the Hamiltonian of this system is described by this expression or an approximation. This is not even the real problem, right? So this is not the very fundamental Hamiltonian. It's an approximation to it. But it's still, it's one of the, you know, one of the basic things that we, yeah.
Could you just clarify the numerator of the middle term E to the, is that a?
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
What did you write there, E?
Yeah, so it's like, this is the norm R. So this is an E, mm-hmm. And this is a ZA. So this is essentially the product of the charge of the electron with the charge of the nuclei.
Okay. And Z is the Pauli operator?
So ZA, so sorry, Z is just a number. So ZA is just the charge of a you know, of the nucleus. You have like protons in it, and they have all a charge plus. It's like the number of essentially that. Yeah. Yes, I think you're right. Yeah. Sorry, it could be. Yeah. So. Which one do you? Oh, you mean this one? Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah. So yeah, I'm always getting confused with the charge size. and then you have like R. So if this is your coordinate system, you know, this position might be, there's some RA here that tells us where is the center of the nucleus. And then you have something like an R. I here, which tells us, you know, this is the position of the electron. I don't want to go too much into detail here. The problem, so what I'm going to say here is like what we're trying to do at the end of the day in condensed matter physics, for example, is trying to find, as an example, the ground state of such a Hamiltonian that will describe a certain properties of materials. I don't know, either a superconductor or a metal or some other material that we have, some sort of crystal material or other. So we can't really solve that because there is this term here. So this is what people call the interaction interaction part. The interaction of the electrons. And that makes that problem a many-body problem. So you have to like sort of find you need to do some sort of approximation to be able to solve this type of problem. So what people in practice then have done over like many, many decades and in the past is try to find other Hamiltonians that represent or approximate the behavior of these of your original system in some way. And these approximations are called model Hamiltonians, and model Hamiltonians, these are the basic, they're the Hamiltonians that we will usually look at when we do tensor network simulations. So the goal, our lofty goal is to use tensor network approaches to approximate ground states of your real Hamiltonian, but that's not possible. So instead of taking the real Hamiltonian, you go to something that is slightly different from your real Hamiltonian, called a model Hamiltonian, that is an approximation to the approximation, and then you try to solve that. But even that model Hamiltonian is very complicated. I just want to write you down a few examples here. All right, so.
An online question. Have you already used the Born-Oppenheimer approximation?
Yes, yeah, that has already been used there. So that has sort of been already factored into this. So this is what I'm saying, that it's like, this is an approximation already. So so typical Hamiltonians or models that we look at with tensor networks are spin models. So spin Hamiltonians. Spin model. One example is de-Ising. That is the most famous one that everyone, like the quantum Ising model. So this is a model of spins on a lattice. So you have a lattice where on each lattice site you can have a spin up or down. So this spin half degree of freedom. And the Hamiltonian of that looks something like this. As x. All right, so, and sometimes you put here in front a parameter. So this is a number, a real number. This is called the coupling strength. This is a magnetic field. And that is one of the Hamiltonians that, you know, we'll look at also in the tutorial. So this is just this Hamiltonian describes the behavior of spins that are like on a lattice. So it's like you can think of having, you know, a lattice of atoms, and the electrons are, there are electrons on this lattice, or maybe, or the spin nuclei, or spin, you know, you have like atomic nuclei that can have spins, but the nuclei themselves are not allowed to move. The only thing that can happen is that for some reason or another, you know, two nuclei that are close to each other can have spin configurations of their nuclear spin that are either aligned or anti-aligned, and there is an energy cost associated with that. That's one of the models. Other models are
S sub to the X is the Pauli X operator acting on site I.
This is the Pauli X operator acting on site I. These are Pauli Z operators acting on sites I and J. And this here is a sum over nearest neighbors, right? So you have, in this case, this is what these angle brackets here denote. You have an interaction here, and here, and then here, and here. You know, each link of the lattice, and sometimes if it's like a, if it's periodic, then, you know, the interactions can also go around in like two directions, something like this. Then it's on a torus. All right. Okay. So that's it. Let's move that one up. Is that the front? So mid comes down. Okay, and I'll skip through the rest of this because I'm running already a little bit short. And Hamiltonians, I think you all know, these are Hermitian. You can view them, each of these matrices, like this H over there, for example, at the top. You can view this as a rectangular matrix that is Hermitian. So it has positive eigenvalues, real eigenvalues. And the size of it grows exponentially with the number of spins. And you can essentially derive all properties. If you would be able to find, so the goal is to find the ground, the eigenstates, the eigenmodes, and the eigenenergies of this thing there, of this linear operator. If you would be able to find them all, then you would have solved the problem. And you could just calculate anything out of this. But of course, that's not possible because the computational cost grows so much. This is why we all need a quantum computer, I guess. All right, okay. Any questions? If not, then I'll move on to this next part, which is density operator again. A review of the density operator, reduced density operators, and entanglement. Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So your model Hamiltonians, you wrote down the model for the quantizing chain.
Yeah.
Are there others that are useful approximations?
There are many. So there is like another one. So I have like some in my notes, but I just want to go through all of them because it's like two. But there is other ones. One is the Hubbard model, for example. So there is a large number for spins. There is spin Hamiltonians, and there are model Hamiltonians that would also capture the charge degrees of freedom. So this is, for example, the Hubbard model. So there, instead of having spins that are localized on a system, you have electrons that can move around, and the electrons can also have a spin. And you can have, so in the Hubbard model, there is like interactions between electrons that is local. So only if electrons are at the same atom, they feel each other, otherwise they don't, which is an approximation. You can extend that. So there is a large number of different types of Hamiltonians that people use to approximate the real problem with the hope of capturing the essential physics that has been observed in an experiment, for example. Okay, so here I just want to review quickly the concept of density operators and reduced density operators. So we were talking about quantum states so far, right? Psi is a pure quantum state. So that's what people... So this means this is at temperature zero and closed system. So when you talk about such a state, what you typically have in mind is the situation where the system is at zero temperature and there is no coupling to the outside world. It's like isolated and left on its own at zero temperature. So if you want to go to something that is more realistic, you need to like, you know, extend the formalism, and this is what people call density matrices. So instead of having a pure state psi, you go and have a matrix, a density operator rho, and that density operator essentially captures all the physics. So that rho here is a, so rho is Hermitian, is a Hermitian matrix. The trace of rho is 1. So these are just like, you know, properties of a density operator. It is positive semi-definite, so it means that the eigenvalues of rho are all bigger or equal to zero. So you know, it's like you typically you write something like this: rho is bigger or equal to zero. What I mean by this is that the eigenvalues of that operator are all bigger or equal to zero. So it's positive semi-definite. Semi means like it could also be zero. And the state, so this is a property, you know, this is like now a definition. If you have an observable that you want to calculate, you know, we all know, so from a pure state, you know, observables are calculated, observables for pure state, as an example, are, so if you are given a pure state, you would like to, for example, compute, you know, the value of Pauli's X operator at position I of your lattice. That's how you calculate it. Right, so this is essentially take a vector, multiply it by matrix, and take the conjugate of the vector, multiply it on top of it. If you look at the density matrix, for density matrices, this gets a little bit modified. It looks like this. So the expectation value, so we write this as the expectation value of I, that's really a definition, is the trace of rho with that operator O. So this is definition. And because the trace is cyclic, you can just permute that through in this case. All right, another definition, or that's just a prescription of how you compute observables. And then another important property of this. And we call now, there's like density operators coming to flavors, pure or mixed. And we call, in general, our density operator is mixed, or is pure. Let me put it that way. A pure density, pure rho, if is given if rho squared is equal to rho. Okay, if you square rho and it's the same, like if as it was before, then it's a pure state. Otherwise, it's a mixed state. And as an example, let me, where do we put that? Here, we can look at the following example. If you take rho to be this state, for example, up. So you have a spin 1/2 system, and you define rho to be of this form, then that's a pure state. Because rho squared, if you compute rho squared, you will see that you just go with on the right-hand side another with another guy of this form. So it's up. And that is just up. Because can you read this? Is that clear what I'm saying? Okay, is it clear what I'm writing here? Very good. So rho squared equals rho, so it's a pure state. So let me actually, this is pure. And mixed would be a state where, as an example, you write something like this. You have alpha, some number, real number, up, plus some beta, down, where alpha plus beta equals 1. And that is a mixed state. This is now a mixture between an up and a down state of your system. And that is not a pure state, because if you would compute rho squared, you would see that it's not equal to rho. All right, we're not going to do that. We'll just leave that for maybe.
Alpha and beta real numbers?
Yes, alpha and beta real numbers in this case. And there have they sum to 1. Because you want the trace of rho to be 1, right? So the trace of rho is given by alpha plus beta in this case. All right. Which is the next of the rear, I guess. Okay.
If you made alpha and beta complex numbers, could potentially still be a pure state.
So if you made alpha and beta complex, so
it would just be a super.
The problem is then it's no longer Hermitian. So the eigenvalues are no longer real. So the reason why, so what one wants to do, like rho can be interpreted, the diagonals of rho can always be interpreted as a probability distribution. I can give you another example. Like another example of rho, of an interesting rho, would be, you know, I'll just write it here, would be the Boltzmann factor, right? E to the minus beta h, where beta is an inverse temperature. So what you want to do is, like, in the case that this is some sort of a classical system, you know, this is a matrix. And if you would diagonalize that thing, you would end up with a matrix that is, so if H was diagonal, right, then you could diagonalize that whole thing, you would have a matrix that has essentially the energies of the Hamiltonian on the diagonal, and you would like to, you interpret this here essentially as a distribution, you know, the distribution of possible states that your system could be in. So it, this is why that sort of definition makes sense. It sort of captures these all these cases where you'd like to where you'd like to apply to. Does it make sense? Okay. So, all right, there we go. Now let's look at the reduced density matrix. So there's another concept called reduced density matrix that is closely connected to this one. And what we're doing here is we are breaking our system up into two pieces. We have a system A and a system B. So this is now could be spins on a lattice, for example. You know, it's like I've drawn a circle, but you could think of there could be lattice, you know, a lattice of spins in here and here as well. We're now given a state on that combined system, right? So there's a state rho AB on this combined system rho AB. So this is a quantum. So this is just something that we're given, right? Let's say it could be, again, a Boltzmann factor or, you know, so a Boltzmann distribution or something like that. So then the reduced density matrix, that's a definition. So I'll put that here. I keep forgetting this is mid. No, it's, which one is it? Rear. Okay. So we'll define the reduced density matrix, rho A, or I will write it this way, reduced density matrix rho A. We'll define that as the trace over some region B of rho A B. Okay, is everyone, are people familiar with that concept? Okay, so this is the definition of the reduced density matrix. So rho A, so what this is essentially you trace out all the degrees of freedom that are in this region here, and you end up with a system that is only living on A. Okay? Diagrammatically, you know, let's do it diagrammatically quickly because it's very simple. You write your rho AB is this. Right? So this is a representation of this density matrix that you're given by someone on system A and B. And now you trace out region B. So IA and IB are basis states that IA are basis states that span all of A. IB are basis states that span the Hilbert space of B. And now you're tracing out B, which essentially means you're doing that. And you end up with an object that is only living on A. That has IA prime IA. And that is your reduced density matrix on A. So reduced density matrices and properties of those are very, like, play important roles in understanding certain, you know, how tensor networks and when tensor networks are applicable to solve certain types of problems. So we'll come back to that later. So an important note is that even if that rho AB that I gave you was a pure state, right, then tracing out A, or in this case, yeah, tracing out B of rho AB leaves you with a rho A that is no longer a pure state, right? So in general, rho A is mixed. Okay, that's very important. So add this as a side note, even if rho AB was pure. Okay, so you start with a pure state, but once you trace out some part of it, you end up with a state that is no longer pure. And there are some exceptions, and one exception is what people call unentangled systems. So if A and B have a very special form. For example, if rho AB had this form, psi A, tensor psi B, right? For such, so that is sort of an exception. If the system had this form, which means there is, it's a pure state on A, tensor, a pure state on B, then if you trace out A, then B is still, or if you trace out B, then A will still be a pure state. And these are systems. In this case, we would say that A and B are unentangled. There's no entanglement between A and B. Okay, any questions? Yes? If you had more than, I mean, you mean, if you have, you can divide it into multiple subsystems, but you can, usually you trace out one of them, right? And then you end up with a system that is defined on all of the other ones except the one that you just traced out. So you can decompose that. You could have some C in here, right? But then you could trace out, I mean, the argument really that we don't really consider, so it's always bipartite. We always consider like a case where you trace out one part and the other. So it's always either or. There's no third, there's no third region involved in the argument at this point. All right, so let's see. So I guess we're back at rear. Okay, so entanglement and entanglement entropy. That's the next thing I want to quickly discuss. It's called entanglement and entanglement entropy. Entanglement entropy. So, and I'll first start with a definition. So one, the definition that, you know, I think that you may be already familiar with is the definition of the von Neumann entropy of a density matrix. So there is the so-called von Neumann entropy that people denote by capital S of some matrix rho, all right? And that is defined as S of rho. That's a mapping from matrices to real numbers minus the trace of rho log 2 of rho. So this is the definition of the entanglement entropy, or von Neumann entanglement entropy. You can see by using a spectral, you can do the spectral decomposition of rho, right? So you can write rho in its diagonal basis. You will see that spectral decomposition of rho is just something like this, dii, where these are positive numbers that sum up to one, right? This is a, we can say that this is essentially a probability. These are probabilities. Probabilities. So if you insert that, you will see that this is nothing else than a generalization of the Shannon entropy that people use in information theory.
That's the trace of rho inside of the logarithm.
Sorry? Oh, sorry. Yeah, that is. It's like the trace is the last thing you do.
Sorry, I meant when you put rho inside of a logarithm, is that logarithm of its eigenvalues?
Yes. So if you put that in, right? So what do you do? Yeah, so exactly. So you put that in here. So then, let me actually make it as this. If you put that in, then you will end up, you know, with minus the sum, because you can apply the function to the eigenvalues of the operator, right? So then you end up with a pi times the log of pi. And that is, some people, you know, write this, and you can replace this with, so it's the average information content. So if you're interested, like David McKay has a very good book about this where you can read up all of this stuff. All right, so if you have a system of two, So again, we'll look at, here we go. So we're already running late. Is it okay if we go like until 45? Yeah, okay, yeah, 45. I'll try to stop there, and then tomorrow we'll do a little bit more than what I expected. So let's see, so here we are. So let's look at an example, right? So we'll look at the example of the spin 1/2 system. That's just like the favorite example of everybody, like everyone's favorite system, rho given by here, p times up plus 1 minus p times down, right? So that is a reduced density matrix for a spin 1/2 system. So if you plug that in, you will see this, you know, the S of rho in this case is, so we get like P times the log 2 of 1 over P plus 1 minus P times the log 2 of 1 over 1 minus P. This is what people call the binary entropy function, and it's a very, very important function that shows up in many different types of places, but here I just want to plot that function for you as a function of p, right? So here you have s of rho. So p goes from 0 to 1, right? So p, so that we want to have a good density matrix, so we constrain p to be between 0 and 1. So if you look at this function s of rho here, so here is 1. Here is 0. How does it look like? It's like this. So that's it. And it has a maximum here. And the maximum value is 1. Sometimes people call this in 1 bit or 1 e-bit or something like that. Very good. OK. So does anyone know how that, let's look at a more general case. What happens, and you know, we're not going to do that. So we know now like this binary entropy function has a maximum at p equal to 1/2. That means all the p's, so this means here is 1/2, and this is also 1/2. All states are equally probable, right? So this is the maximum. It turns out that for more than 2, you know, let's say 10, does anyone know where does that function take the maximum?
So all like uniform distributions.
Yes, when you have the uniform distribution, it's the maximum. It has the least amount of, so it has the highest entropy and the least amount of information in it. So, yeah, and we'll use that actually later on. So this we'll come back to that type of problem. So one important or one interesting fact about these matrices is the following. So this was the rear already, so we'll go back front, which is that if you take the entropy of two independent distributions, then it sums up individually. So that is also, I think, worth remembering. So if you have, and that there is a generalization to that to quantum systems. So if you have a density matrix rho that is rho A tensor rho B, it follows that S of rho is given by S of rho A plus S of rho B. So they sum, right? Very simple. That's only the case if, so this is the case if they are, they are unentangled in a sense. And that is a generalization of the same statement holds for the von Neumann entropy, for the Shannon entropy for probability distributions. Okay, so now we're, I think, in a state where we can, start defining the entangled quantum system. So, with another definition here. Entangled quantum systems, or entangled, what is an entangled quantum system? Or what are entangled quantum systems? So to explain that, what I'll do is we will consider again a system that is decomposed into A and B. So we have a bipartite system. And we'll assume now that the state on those is pure. So we have a state psi AB that is living on that combined system AB. And if you go now, you can compute the density matrices. So there is a density matrix associated with that. There is a rho AB, which is given by this, psi AB times psi AB. And what we'll do now is we'll trace out one part of the system, let's say A. So we'll compute, or we did B before, let's do B again. So we'll do trace over B of rho AB, which is, you know, by our definition called the reduced density matrix on rho A. And where is it here? And now we can compute the entanglement entropy of this row A here, right? So now you compute S of row A. There we go. And if that is bigger than zero, we call those systems entangled. Okay, so this is what we mean by entangled systems. So if you have, So you look at a pure state on a larger quantum system, you compute the reduced density matrix of that system, you trace out one region, and then you look at the entanglement entropy of the other region, then you will see that for systems that are not entangled, it will be zero, and for systems that are entangled, it will be bigger than zero. And that is essentially like the core. That will be the notion of entanglement that we'll use going forward. It will be based on the von Neumann entropy. You can also use other entropies for that. We'll not do that in this course. We'll be entirely looking at von Neumann entropies. Okay, so example. And then we'll stop. Example. Two spin one half. I'll promise we'll at some point leave the space of two spin one half systems, but for now we'll stay here for a little bit longer. So you have a psi AB, which is something like a 1 over this. What do we have here? And there will be some normalization factor, square root of 2, up A, down B, or did I? Yeah, that's it. And then you have a down A, up B. So this is a spin triplet. Okay, so this is what people call a spin triplet state. Now you can compute the density matrix rho. You can compute, so if you do rho AB, you know, rho AB, I'm not going to do it. It will be some expression. You can do that yourself. And then you do rho A, trace of rho B, also trace over B of rho AB. And you will see that this turns out to be 1/2 times the identity matrix. Okay? So that is a pure or mixed? Yes, exactly. It's a maximally mixed state. So we'll have that the two systems, so this means that it follows that S of rho A is maximal, okay? And that means that the systems are maximally entangled, so you can't entangle them anymore. All right, that's it. I think we'll stop here, and tomorrow we'll start again from, you know, do the rest of this part, and then we'll move on to the first tensor network stuff. Okay, if there's any questions, questions? If not, yeah, well, let's conclude it here. Thanks.